Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Jack the Ripper baffles Scotland Yard.
1888, Whitechapel, home to East London's sex trade. A sinister shadow stalked its dark brooding alleys, brutally slaying a slew of so-called fallen women in a vicious spree over just a few streets. Fleeing unseen and leaving no clues, the mystery of Jack the Ripper's identity and motive fueled a burgeoning tabloid media baying for blood and print, making his killings as infamous today as they were back then. Jack the Ripper was the first spree killer of his kind, but he wasn't the last.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Soho Strangler battles Scotland Yard.
1935, Soho. Almost 50 years later, and 3 miles west, an unseen slayer stalked the fog-wreathed streets of West London's red light district. 4 women, all poor, all foreign, all linked to the sex trade, and all unnervingly similar in life and looks, were strangled alone in their beds with escalating ferocity. Dubbed the Soho Strangler, this lone maniac terrified these few streets, leaving women in fear, the police at a loss, and with no witnesses or clues. Even today, all 4 murders remain unsolved. Syndicated worldwide, newspapers from London to Lisbon, Chicago to Karachi, fed off the fever of his killing spree. It made Soho a byword for terror, the Strangler a sadist to be feared, and it bestowed a notoriety on his 4 unfortunate victims: French Fifi, Marie Cotton, Dutch Leia, and French Marie. The Soho Strangler was the Jack the Ripper of his era. But with the fascists on the rise, Nazis seizing power, and a real horror looming on the horizon, death would soon come not to a few, but to hundreds in Soho and millions across the world. And although both cases were strangely similar, one remained infamous, as the other was entirely forgotten. Limitless books have tried to solve the riddle of the Ripper killings, but what stalls every investigation is the lack of evidence, as most of the documents were either lost, stolen, or inaccurately regurgitated by a tabloid press focused on speed and not accuracy. 135 years on, it's unlikely that the Ripper will ever be solved. And yet in the case of the Soho Strangler, we have everything. From court records to police files, autopsy reports, witness statements, coroner's inquests, and full histories of his victims and suspects. Told in full for the very first time. This is the true story of Britain's long-forgotten serial killer, the Soho Strangler. Archer Street, Soho. The seedy heart of the West End's theatre and sex trade is a cramped little slit between Piccadilly Circus, Shaftesbury Avenue and Old Compton Street. Riddled with jazz joints, jizz parlours, pubs, clubs and brothels, it hummed with the sordid bristle and stench of booze and sex. Monday the 4th of November 1935, just shy of noon. Elderly French maid Felicity Plaisant strolled into 3-4 Archer Street. Passing the windmill, Soho's infamous burlesque club, the street door was unlocked as usual as she ascended the staircase. The Cairo Club in the basement and the Globe Club on the first floor was silent, except for the scrubbing of cleaners prepping for the late-night trade. With the second floor currently vacant, and the third and fourth floors sublet to four sex workers in four single flats. As a prostitute's maid, Felicity worked a 12-hour shift for a modest wage of £1 per week. Her job, to make the bed, to wash the sheets, to empty the ashtray, to ensure the room was spick and span, and to generally be invisible to any good or nervous clients, and yet visible to those who were bad. On the third floor, she unlocked the door to flat one, seeing no movement beyond its frosted glass. With the hall often silent at this hour, Felicity crept in as her employer, 41-year-old French prostitute, Mrs. Josephine Martin, known as French Fifi, slept till mid-afternoon, having worked from 5 p.m. to 3 a.m. Nothing seemed out of place. The rug had rocked up, as it often did, when Madame opened the door. Several cigarette butts littered the ashtray, and a half-eaten meal of eggs and tea adorned the kitchen table. Pretty much, the flat was as she had left it 36 hours earlier. With no client seen, through a slightly ajar curtain, she saw Fifi alone on the bed, fully dressed and flaked out. As per usual, Felicity popped a kettle on the hob to make them both a cuppa for the long day ahead. Felicity would state, "I took her to the bedroom. She was lying on her back with her feet on the floor and with one shoe and stocking off. I put the tea on the dressing table. I caught hold of her hand and shook it and said, 'Here's your tea, madam.' Her hand was stiff and cold. I then realised she was dead." Having taken her own life, using her own stocking to seize her own breath, her passing marked the sad and tragic end to the turbulent life of a good woman who only wanted to be loved. Sickness, loss, and depression had pockmarked her final years, only for her to succumb to a very lonely suicide. The death of French Fifi was as unremarkable as it was forgotten. Long before she hid behind her alias, French Fifi was born Josephine Mécanique on the 22nd of July, 1894, in Paris. The eldest of two siblings, with an older brother, Albert. Raised by Russian Jews in a French suburb, the family frequently moved to flee their persecution as immigrants. And given her chaotic upbringing, it was no surprise that wherever she fled to, Josephine was always desperate to find love. Seen as softly spoken and sensitive, she was described as a good girl who kept her family well. A quiet soul who seldom spoke to anyone. And a woman who didn't just fall in love, she becomes besotted and will do anything for the person she adores. Being easy on the eye, Josephine was a petite and slightly plump brunette, with her hair in a bob, long fingernails, and a set of ruby red lips. In 1901, for reasons unknown, 7-year-old Josephine was brought to England, leaving behind her mother, but followed 1 year later by 16-year-old Albert. Working alongside her tailor father in the French parts of Soho, she was educated and she knew the streets well, but her English would always be broken. Age 14, she returned to Paris. Only her true home would hold nothing but horror for this young girl. According to James Orr, a later lover of Josephine's, some man became acquainted with her. Being so besotted by him that she did as he bade, he put her on the streets. A little girl forced to sell her virginity to seedy strangers in Rue Pigalle, the dark and dangerous streets of Paris's red light district. Made pregnant by a man who pimped her out and pawned off her illegal earnings, her illegitimate child was born in secret, adopted under a false name, and she never saw her only child ever again. By the end of the First World War, and after 4 years of prostitution, Fifi moved back to London. Although it's uncertain if she fled, or she was trafficked by French pimps as part of the white slave trade. In September 1919, at Marylebone Registry Office, barely months after her return to Soho, 24-year-old Josephine Mécanique married British citizen Henry V. Martin, a waiter at the nearby Trocadero. I wish I could tell you that she found love and lived happily ever after. But she didn't. It's likely that this was a marriage of convenience, possibly paid for by her pimps, so her newly established British citizenship would make it impossible to deport her for the crime she would commit to pay off her debts to her pimps. After just 6 months, Josephine and Henry split, and he promptly moved to America to start a new life for himself, possibly funded by the small wage he was paid for an afternoon's work. She rarely spoke of him again, but having retained his surname and the wedding ring, this would gift her some respectability. That same year, being sick with loneliness, Josephine fell for César Mary, a serial philanderer who worked at the Belgian consulate in Belgravia. Wooing her with fine words and gifting her a good life, of a nice flat, fancy furs, and lavish cocktail parties, he fulfilled her dreams. So besotted was Josephine that on her right thigh, she tattooed an unfortunate epitaph. It read, "To my César, forever till I die." Only with his love a cruel sham, it's likely that his legitimate job was a ruse to hide his illicit affairs. And as was a familiar trick employed by the white slave traders, he gave her everything, only to take it away. Living in poverty, but fueled by the hope of a return to the good life, as French Fifi, Josephine would be forced to pay her way, owing an ever-escalating fee to her pimps, which she could never pay off. And yet, although little and quiet, Josephine had a fiery temper when things got a little too hot. In 1923, after 3 years living under César's rule, she packed up her belongings, moved in with her brother Albert, and doing something as brave as it was foolish, following her arrest for prostitution, she appeared at Bow Street Police Court as witness for the prosecution against César. Found guilty of living off her immoral earnings, he was sentenced to 1 month's hard labour, and as an illegal alien, on the 6th of September 1927, he was deported back to Belgium, later stating, "It was Fifi who put me away." By 1927, after 17 years as a prostitute, all French Fifi knew was sex. Shielded by a nom de plume, her alias gave a hint of the exotic to her working-class punters, but it also shielded her truth in a mystery. As a well-known and well-liked figure in Soho's sex district, she plied her trade on Glasshouse Street, a short thoroughfare from Piccadilly Circus to the eastern edge of Regent Street. She always dressed elegantly in fine furs, neat makeup, and discreet but affordable jewellery. She was always polite, often alone, but blessed with many friends who were prostitutes, they escorted one another for protection. Post César, it is unknown whether she had a pimp. But as Soho's prostitution rackets were run by a slew of foreign criminals, whether French pimps like Roger Vernon and the Marcel Collective, Red Max and the Iron Gang, or Maltese gangsters like the Messina Brothers and the Vassallo Gang, until the day of her death, Josephine would amass 74 convictions for prostitution and brothel keeping. And yet that year would ignite a tragic downfall, which would end in her suicide. In 1928, bucked with cramps, bleeding and dizzy spells, 34-year-old Josephine was rushed to the Middlesex Hospital, as cancer was spotted on her womb. Given an emergency hysterectomy, which saved her life, although she remained under medical care, it would plague her with pains for the rest of her days. Her maid would state, "Madam was always sick." Cursed with sharp pains in her back, hot flushes to her face, dysentery, fever, shortness of breath, and a blood pressure so low, she often passed out. Discharged after 3 months, she went straight back to work, all broken and withdrawn. On the 9th of November 1933, Josephine moved into flat one on the third floor of 3-4 Archer Street in Soho. A busy side street chock full of musicians, dancers and actors, as well as pubs and clubs supplying a passing trade of drunks with ready cash and raging boners. Split into a sitting room, a bedroom, a kitchen and a bathroom, Vera Richards, the landlady, liked her French tenant, as she always kept a spotlessly clean flat, and only once was she late with the £2 rent. For Josephine, her professionalism was a matter of pride. Her dresses were stylish, her fur coats were neat, her makeup was subtle, and her stockings never had a rip nor a run. To her French maid, 72-year-old widow Felicity, she was always kind, caring, and never failed to pay her wage, even if she was short. By 1935, her last year alive, times were hard for Josephine. Described as tight with money and always sober, whereas once this exquisite French beauty, with a doll-like frame, searing blue eyes and pouting red lips, had her pick of the 10 or so clients a night that her sultry Parisian murmur lured in. Now, cracked, faded, and often bedridden for days on end, this middle-aged, lightly graying, slightly pudgy woman struggled to muster 3 drunks, at best 4. According to Millie, a friend and a fellow sex worker, she didn't have a type. She slept with anyone. Chinese, even coloureds. And earning, if it was her own, an okay wage of £4 to £6 per night, depending on the weather. She had no regular callers, and no one came back for a second time. As a teetotaler, her limited funds rarely covered her outgoings. With her looks as her moneymaker, although her long fingernails were always neat and painted, the dental plate of her false teeth was old and worn. She owed debts to her dressmaker. She hocked her furs, and except for a wedding band to Henry Martin, she had pawned all of her jewellery. The police report would state, there is no doubt that she was heavily in debt and living a hand-to-mouth existence. As of those debts that we know of, by the time of her death, she owed £106, 4 shillings and sixpence, roughly £8,500 today, just shy of the annual wage in 1935. But her debt wasn't down to a silly lady struggling to look pretty. As being a good girl who kept her family well, she supported her brother Albert and his wife for months, and often bailed him out of prison when he needed her most. Always frugal, she wasn't a spender, a lush, or a squanderer. It was compassion which was her curse. as fueled by a longing to be loved. She became besotted and would do anything for those she adored. In the summer of 1932, at the Lion's Corner House Tea Room in Piccadilly, Josephine met 29-year-old James Orr, known as Jimmy, a car dealer from Chicago, whose handsome looks had got him bit parts in the movies. What blossomed was love. Real love. To a good man who loved her back. And although her life as a convicted prostitute may have put some men off, Jimmy loved Josephine no matter what. It could have been something wonderful. Only Jimmy had a demon. Heroin. Cursed with the sickness of addiction. Although not a drug user herself, Josephine loved this man who was decent, kind. And through his struggle, she supported him through poverty, pain, and torment to try and save his soul. All she ever wanted was to be loved. And yet once again, love would be denied her. By the autumn of 1935, as the nights drew longer and punters grew fewer, as a 41-year-old, slightly portly lady, with no savings, few family, a recurring sickness, a burden of debt, and unable to move on as she was still legally wed. After a quarter of a century in sex work, her tawdry little life was to be her lot. Felicity would state, "I have not heard her threaten to commit suicide. But almost daily, she complained about things being none too good. I considered this a regular remark in conversation, as she was always fed up." On Friday the 18th of October 1935, 2 weeks before her death, Josephine appeared at Great Marlborough Street Police Station on her final charge of prostitution. As was easiest, she pleaded guilty and she paid the 40-shilling fine to the court's jailer, PC Frederick Pracknell. At her inquest, he would state, "She seemed very depressed. She said, 'I'm fed up with this life. I've got a good mind to finish it. I'm sick of it all.'" Stuck in a vicious cycle of sickness, debt, and loneliness, her unremittingly empty life was hard, getting harder, and worse still, it was dangerous. For prostitutes, violence is an all too common part of daily life. 1 week before her last conviction for prostitution, Millie, her neighbour in flat 2, would state, "I heard a quarrel in her room and knocked on the wall." Later, Josephine admitted, "I had a struggle with a foreigner who got hold of my throat." But for Millie, it was quite usual for Fifi to have rows with the men she brought home. She would demand more than the agreed price, refuse to undress, and she was always in a hurry to get the man out of her flat. It was said by many that she could handle herself when she had to. And too often, she had to. Having been robbed and burgled more times than she could recall, She would never take her stocking off in front of a man, and very seldom dressed before him. Not just to speed up the sex, but she always kept her money in the heel of her left stocking, as witnessed by her maid and friends. Saturday the 2nd of November 1935 was her penultimate day alive. And with it came a tidal wave of emotions. Having seen and supported Jimmy every day for the last 2 years, as much as she would miss him for the next 3 months, she helped him get into Caldecott Hall, a home for inebriates and drug addicts. Without a quibble, she'd always paid his bills, made his meals, gifted him an allowance, and would sacrifice her own needs by sending him to get clean, 91 miles northwest in the Midlands town of Nuneaton. That day, she so wanted to kiss him and to wish him goodbye. But having already left his hotel, it was not to be. The night was cold and glum, as a bitter wind whistled down Archer Street. But drizzle aside, between 9 p.m. and 11 p.m, Fifi picked up three men, unseen by Felicity, and being quick and quiet, they only stayed for 10 minutes. With the £2.05 she made being posted to Jimmy, and a 2 shilling tip for a maid. Having changed the sheets and left the flat pretty much as she would find it 36 hours later, at roughly midnight, as Felicity exited the door, Fifi's last words to her were, "Good night. I'll see you on Monday." At 12:30 a.m, she met Millie at the Continental Cafe on Shaftesbury Avenue and lamented the loss of her lover who was gone. At 1:15 a.m, she handed her brother 6 shillings, as she often did to keep him out of debt. And from 1:30 a.m. till 6 a.m, she stayed with her friend Frieda, smoking cigarettes and eating pies. That night, they planned to meet up again. Only this would be the last sighting of French Fifi. At 5:30 p.m, Frieda called Fifi's phone in the flat. She sounded happy, and she said she'd see me later, as they often escorted each other on their patches, Frieda on Green Street and Fifi on Glasshouse Street. As agreed, Frieda waited for her pal at their pre-planned place and time. Only oddly, Fifi never arrived. Interviewed days later, there were a few possible sightings of Fifi, only the details cannot be verified. Between 9:15 and 10 p.m, Sidney Bloom, a Jewish seller of contraception to prostitutes in the West End, said he saw Fifi on her patch and get off with her client. At 9:20 p.m, Millie in flat 2 heard Fifi shout, "I can't see the money. You haven't put it down." The couple briefly rowed, and the man left. At 2 a.m, James Weller, a doorman at Max Club at 41 Great Windmill Street, a road west of Fifi's flat, said, "She wanted to come in. I said no, as women can't come in unless escorted by a gentleman. They had a laugh, and she seemed normal, and then left. And seeing her turn left into Ham Yard, Beatrice, the owner of Old Friars Cafe at 16 Ham Yard, served her semi-regular customer a black coffee. According to Beatrice, she sat alone. Her arms were folded. She spoke to no one. And I thought she looked really tired. If those dates and times were right, at a little after 2 a.m., one street east, Fifi entered 3-4 Archer Street. Only nobody saw her, and with the clubs closed and the tenants out, nobody heard her. Alerted by her mate, Felicity Pleasant. At 1:50 p.m, Divisional Detective Inspector John Edwards and Police Surgeon Charles Burney conducted an in-situ examination of the body and the scene. With every door and window locked and in good working order, there were no signs of a break-in. With no hint of a robbery, disturbance or a struggle, foul play was not suspected. And with a half-eaten meal for one, of fried eggs and a pot of tea on the kitchen table, it looked as if she had dined alone and went to bed. With the lights out and the curtains still partially drawn, even at night, the bedroom would have been lit by the street lamps outside and the flats opposite, revealing the cold dead body of Fifi on the bed. Lying on her back and fully clothed, as if she was merely dozing, her face was described as peaceful, like her pain had been taken away, as on the dresser lay painful reminders of her sad little life. Post office receipts to fund Jimmy's recovery, and a recent court summons for the crime of prostitution. Her hair was still tidy, her clothes weren't disarranged, her fingernails were unbroken, and as she only did when she was alone, she had removed a stocking from her left leg. She had unclipped it and carefully rolled it down so it didn't have a tear, a rip, or a run. Keen to find peace, she wrapped it twice around her neck. She tied a half-hitch knot to take the load. And as she pulled it tight, her low blood pressure made her pass out, and the stocking stopped her breath. With rigor mortis delayed by sudden trauma, her time of death was established as 8 to 10 hours prior. And with no recent bruising, Dr. Burney concluded it was probably a case of suicide. Released by the coroner, Mr. Ingleby Oddy, 4 days later, her body was buried, her funeral paid for by a Jewish charity. By the evening, a few local papers reported the death by suicide of a Soho prostitute known as French Fifi. Only being hastily written by tabloid hacks, many were short and inaccurate, as if nobody cared. The suicide of French Fifi was as unremarkable as it was to be forgotten. And yet, it was the first fledgling killing of the Soho Strangler.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
By jingle, wah! Oh, lordy, lordy, up on high. Hello, everyone. How are we? Are we all good? Do you know what? I'm not going to make a cup of tea. I'm not going to make a cup of tea, only because I've been teeing all day, and I've got... Yeah. Diet Coke, lime. I shouldn't really have a Coke, because... As we know, it's an irritant to the bowel, and because I'm an older gentleman now, I've had these conversations with people in their 40s as well, and we all seem to realise that you can have one coffee and then you're weeing all day. So I'm an old person, what can I say? Welcome to Extra Mile, the unscripted, unedited bit. See, I've been away for too long, I can't remember stuff anymore. What's been going on? This, really, basically... I did all my episodes pre-Christmas, got them all done before December, so it gave me December to do research, and I was researching right through January on this project, which in total it's taken me about 8 years to do this. The bulk of it has taken the last couple of months, the last 6 or 7 months, but it's taken about 8 or 9 years, about 8 years to do this. But the last couple of months have been really interesting. It's one of these cases that's always been on the cards, and I always kept thinking, let's do it one day, because I used to do it on my tours. I used to do a version of it, a little version, which was okay. But I always thought, yeah, one day I'm going to do this properly. And because I had access to all of the court records, all the police files, everything's there, I just thought, right, let's just sit down and do it. So, yeah, I've been away slogging my guts out getting this done. And it's a fascinating case. It really is. This is not going to go the way you think it's going to go. Like, Blackout Ripper was interesting, but Blackout Ripper was logical. It's one man. It goes on a logical route. You can follow his journey. It made sense. This one's really complicated. This one... The more I researched it, the more my head started exploding because there's a lot in it. This episode is quite a simple one, but I've had to put a lot into this episode and take a lot out. There's a lot in here that leads to the other 9 episodes. So I'm taking you on a journey already. You may think there's not a lot in there, but there's a lot that I've packed into this one. It's a bigger episode than it seems. Part 2 next week, we will unearth the second part of French Thief. So basically, it's going to go... There'll be 2 episodes per victim. And oh, you're probably going, hang on, 4 victims, 10 episodes. What's going on? Yes! Don't worry, there's a lot more murders than 4 in here. Christ. Even when I was researching this, I even said to myself, oh, fuck, not another murder. There's a lot. There's a lot in here. And it's a really fascinating case, so I hope you stay for the long haul on this one. It's really worth it. And the great thing is, there's nothing out there about it. The only thing that's really out there is... I've deleted most of it now, but there's bits and pieces out there that I did for the tour I've deleted most of my blog posts about it, so there's no spoilers in there. Obviously, coming up is Dutch Lair, who we covered in episode 4, I think. But this is a different version of that. This is connected to the Soho Strangler. So, yeah, there's a lot to explore. So, yeah, let's... all exciting. Yeah. And, of course, and not because I forgot to do it in the episode and I'm recording this later on, but you can tell I haven't done a podcast in a little while. A little thank you to all the new Patreon subscribers. Who are Becky Connor, Wodka Pashtuma Bichla, I hope I got that right. I have been on the internet, had a look around, hope I got it right. Jackie Causer, Daniel Bronx, Truman, Matthew Nielsen, Daisy, Linda, Mandy Latcham, Hazel Hawkett, Molly Doherty, Angela Leonard, and Linda Johnson. Cool, dear, that's a lot of people. A lot of people subscribed December, January, and this is our first episode back, so there's a lot of people to thank there. Also a thank to Dawn Smith for your very kind donation. That was very much appreciated and spent on goodies. So, what else has been going on? I've had the boat out of the water for a week, which was doing regular repairs to it, just... the problem that week when I got the boat out of the water, which gives you a chance to go underneath the boat and go into all the little crevices that you normally can't get access to, I came down with norovirus, the one where you're basically vomiting all the time and shitting like you're pissing. And oh god, it was horrible. And even worse, it gives you a really horrible eggy breath, like you're the devil. So I had to do my repairs while shitting and puking and everything. It was horrible. I was walking from town. I grabbed myself something to bung me up a bit so I could do some work. And as I walked through the local park, I went to sneak out a little fart for big danger and shat myself. Absolutely shat myself. Luckily, I wasn't wearing shorts that day. Made it to the boat centre where my boat was. And the second I got in there, the engineer wanted to have a nice long conversation with me that was really important. So I had to stand there having a nice chat with him while shit was running down my leg. Oh, joy. Oh, joy. Oh, God, what a week. And then the laptop died. The laptop, the one, my main one, which I've been using for ages, that finally died. It died in December. I had it rebuilt. It died in January, and I thought, fuck it. So I've lost some stuff because Google Drive didn't save everything. But I've rebuilt. So this is my new laptop, which is a duplicate of my other backup laptop. So I now have two laptops, one online, one offline, one connected to Google Drive. Direct one not, but they're identical laptops almost, so I can literally jump between them, which is great. Oh, so hopefully no more technical problems for at least a year. That would be lovely. Thank you very much. What else is going on? I think that's it, pretty much. This is a 10-parter. I might do an omnibus edition at the end. Don't forget, if you're a Patreon subscriber, throughout January I've done some walk with me's for everyone, but don't forget, when I finished editing, I always do a walk with me, which is basically I go through and tell you everything that I've edited out of the episode. So all the stuff that you will never hear in Extra Mile, I tell you about all the little secrets that are hidden away in the episodes as well. So all the little sounds that you won't know about, there's and quite often I put in red herrings. I'll make you aware of that. You know, you learn all the proper secrets. And sometimes I go down Dogger's Alley and we go and look at all the people who are dogging, which is always good fun. Right, let's do some quiz questions and then we'll dive into some extra stuff in this episode. Hang on. There we go. Right, okay. Quiz questions, there'll be answers at the end, so let's get ready to rumble. Question number one. Name the three clubs nearest to 3-4 Archer Street. Name the three clubs which were nearest and in 3-4 Archer Street. So three clubs in and around 3-4 Archer Street. What were they called? I should have just written the question that way. Question number two. What was Fifi's last known meal? God, I got cake over there. I've bloody saved that since I was going to eat it when I started writing it. Oh, 5 this morning. I was going to eat it. I thought I'd save it for Extra Mile, but it's over there now and I can't be asked. So that was question two. What was French Fifi's last known meal? Oh, Question three, what was French Fifi's birth name? Question four, what was her parents' nationality and religion? Question five, in which part of Paris was Fifi a prostitute? Question six, where did her husband Henry work? Question number seven, César was deported back to which country? Question number eight, what part of Soho was a patch? Question nine, what hospital did she go to for cancer treatment? And question number 10, where did she meet Jimmy Orr? Right, where did she first meet Jimmy Orr, that should really say. Right, let's dive into some extra stuff. Obviously, this is the first episode of all of these. I don't want to give away stuff that will ruin any of the future episodes because I haven't written those yet. And we've got a lot that we need to pack into part two next week. I don't want to give away stuff for that. So let's just kind of cover some basics that we've got here. So Josephine later became incoming Josephine Martin. She's 41 years old, although the press said she was 48 at times. 5 foot tall, described as well-built, rounded face, often wore dark clothes. Seemed to have started out relatively well, wearing lots of furs, but as you can see through time, money becomes a real problem, and therefore she's having to hawk a lot of things. This is kind of a common thing that people would do. If you couldn't, obviously there weren't, you couldn't really afford to go to shops. You know, there were tailors and things like that, but there weren't department stores where you could go and buy clothes. So you'd have to get them made for you. Obviously this would cost money. So if people couldn't afford clothes, you'd have to hock them. You'd have to take them down to the pawn shop, and they would give you a chitty. You could keep your clothes, but then you'd have to pay later on to kind of own them. So it kind of became a way of getting a bit of money back, being able to keep your own clothes. But it's a complicated system. But unfortunately, with people working hand to mouth, that's the way it was. So she's not a stupid woman by any means. It's just she's got ever-increasing debts, so she's losing a lot of her jewellery, her clothing, she's having to hawk things. If any of these stories that we look at in the past, people are constantly having to hawk things in order just to survive. Everyone said she was really nice, she's quite quiet, she didn't seem to drink. I had a little bit of a history in there. It looked like after she had her cancer operation, it looked like she tried to go straight. It looked like she tried to, I didn't put this in the story because it slowed it down. I needed to gather some speed again. It looked like she tried to get a job as a housekeeper for a bit over in Chelsea, which she did. But she started drinking. It wasn't reliable. She just didn't seem to settle. So she went back to sex work. But after that, she quit drinking. So even Charles Bull, who we'll learn about probably more like next week, who ran doorman at one of the clubs in the same place, he said she was always quiet and she did not drink. Everyone pretty much says the same, that she did not drink. What else have we got? Always looks after her family, always seems like a good person. You know, I can't seem to find anyone who kind of had anything bad to say about her. She's very much kind of like Ginger Ray in episodes 8 and 9. Very similar. Her father was a tailor. They had connections to the West End and Soho. We don't know why he left in 1901 with her to come to England. Her mother stayed in Paris. Her mother was still alive when she died, but post Josephine becoming pregnant when she was about 14, 15 years old, and the child being given up for adoption, apparently her father died shortly after that. I didn't put that in the episode because it slows it down, but her brother Albert had already moved to the UK by that point. He moved in 1902 to 7-8 Leicester Place, so just off Leicester Square. He was always in a bad financial situation. We'll probably get into more of that next week. We don't know how she got into prostitution. We know it was early. We know someone who was acquainted with her, we don't know who that was, tried to put her on the streets. This happened. She became pregnant. But this, we've kind of seen these stories before. If you look at Susan Latterly, this is what we're coming across, and we're entering this with the kind of what we know about the white slave trade in here, this is very much a tactic that they use. They find a woman who's kind of may already be in the sex trade, kind of goes, oh, I love you. Oh, it's going to be you and me together. She falls in love with him. He says, oh, well, do you know, you're earning money like this. If you work harder as a sex worker for like 2 more years and then we can live a great life together. It's a simple ploy. Basically, she got lured in. She got pregnant. She ends up in debt. She's stuck for her life, and this kind of became her thing. We don't know anything about the child she gave birth to. We don't know whether it was a boy or a girl. We don't know anything about it. This would have happened in France, so we have no details about that. Henry V. Martin, her first husband, inverted commas. They could have met. It could have been a very kind of standard meet and greet up. But there's too much about this that just seems wrong. The speed of which they kind of got together and married. You know what? It does happen. None of the parents were invited. So that I think the father would have been dead by that point. The mother wasn't invited. Albert was a witness there. But she never talked about Henry after that. Now, she was one of these people who really, really kind of fell in love with people. But all we really know about Henry is what Albert told us. And I've always been a bit dubious about Albert. Albert kind of, I find a little bit, he's dubious. That's all I'm going to say. They split, but didn't divorce after about 6 months. 6 months was about the kind of the average for these marriage of conveniences. Because by that point, if you're a foreigner, you're not really being watched that carefully. After, if you've done your 6 months, he disappeared off to America. It's likely that he was funded owing to the money he would have made turning up as a inverted commas groom. This is something that still happens in this country all the time, and actually a lot of countries, that a lot of people from overseas who want to get their passport, they hire someone who pretends to be their boyfriend. But which is why with marriages now, when you sit down with the registrar has to ask you lots of questions about your life and your lover and, you know, what their parents do, just to kind of assess whether you're one of these people who's just lying their ass off just to get a passport. César Mary, what a name. See, well, it's written as I pronounced it César Mary because he's French. Well, he's not French. But what a name, Mary. Maybe it's Marie. César Mary, maybe that's it. Seems like a bit of an arsehole, a bit of a philanderer. Worked for the consul in Belgravia in Eaton Square. Couldn't find out much about him. He doesn't seem to be a diplomat, but it's likely that he worked there as maybe a clerk. But as we will see later on, there's with the white slave trade, a lot of the white slavers have legitimate jobs which hide their illegal activities. A lot of people do that now, which is why in a lot of these cases, when you look at the arrest records of these guys, maybe they're drug dealers, maybe they're kidnappers or things like that. But when the police ask them what they do as a job, they go kitchen porter. Do you know, they put down the regular standard job that they do in other hours that they probably don't do that much of, but it gives them a bit of a cover, and this is kind of something that you will see going right through this episode. César, it was known, he was already married. He was living with his wife and a mistress, and Fifi was one of his mistresses as well. And there were letters passed around, and one of them said, I heard that he was poncing off Fifi Martin, which was the other name that some people called her, you know, Mrs. Martin or Fifi Martin. They were living together for about 3 years until she had him arrested. Well, she didn't quite have him arrested. He got arrested, and to kind of preserve herself, I mean, she could have just sat there and no, I don't know anything about it, but she didn't. She wanted to get rid of him because he was an illegal immigrant. It's probably the great thing to do. She turned around and went, yep, this is what he did. And therefore he got deported. We don't know whether he ever saw her again, but as we will later see in the series, even when people are deported overseas, there's nothing really to stop them coming back. There's no real checks. You can kind of just dip in and out whatever you like. What else have we got? Just conscious that we don't go too far into this. Fifi is a sex worker. We know her patch. That's one of the questions. I won't do that. Pimp. We don't know whether she had a pimp post César. I think it's likely that she did. This is something that we'll dive into later on, is down to the ownership of the house, of where she lived. If you think about it, like there's four flats, and four of them are prostitutes live in there. So likelihood is. But we'll dive into a lot of that later on. I don't want to ruin too much. Unfortunately, in the file, her criminal record wasn't in there. So we know that she has 47 criminal offences for prostitution and brothel keeping, but we don't know what they are. I did some digging, and what's that noise? The boat about to go past with a really horrible engine. It's got really high-pitched whine. Get it fixed. 18th of December 1920, police raided a maisonette, so it's a flat with several bedrooms over two floors, at 42 Bryanston Street, so that's Marylebone. Josephine Martin, 26, the tenant was brought before Marylebone Police Court and fined £12 and £5 costs for using the place for improper purposes. Police had kept surveillance on the flat prior. Three other women were seen to use the place. Besides the accused, and a Japanese was found there. You'll have noticed this already, but there's a little bit of, the reference I had to do earlier on, where it's like, she would sleep with anyone, Chinese, even a coloured. It's like, it's that era, you just got to kind of accept that that's what it is. And here it's like, couldn't even be asked to say a Japanese person. It's like, a Japanese was found there. It's that era. The accused was heard to say, if I had been by myself, it would have been all right. The thing is, because there's multiple prostitutes in the same flat, that constitutes a brothel, even though they may not be working together. But this is the same problem that often with sex workers, they will meet outside, but they can't go into a flat together to see each other, because if they are caught together, that classifies as a brothel, even though they're not engaging in sex work. So, it makes for a really odd one. Her cancer, she was in hospital for 3 months on that. This, don't forget, this is an era before the NHS that we have now, before our government sells off the rest of it or mismanages it to the point where they sell it off at a bargain price and then conveniently become directors of whatever new institution becomes the NHS. That's what they're doing. Utter wankers. Anyway, the wonderful NHS. This is pre-NHS. So obviously you got sick, you go into hospital and you'd have to pay your money there and then to get well, which is a ridiculous way to live a life. So that would have meant a lot of debt to her as well. So 3 months in hospital plus paying for all of her cancer treatment as well. Thank God for the NHS. Wonderful service. Let's enjoy it while it's still here. 1929 to 1932, it was said that she worked as a servant, but she has a criminal conviction there for being drunk and disorderly in Chelsea, for hurling abuse at another woman, and she was sentenced to a day in prison. Apparently after that she stopped drinking, she went entirely teetotal, but she returned to prostitution. If you think about it, she's 1910, she started being a prostitute, so by 1929, that's almost 20 years as a prostitute. It's going to be hard to kind of go back to doing something else when you've been doing one thing for so long. Jimmy, we might dive into a little bit more later on. He said he was a film artist. It turns out he was a bit of a background artist. He'd worked in the Navy for years. He came from Chicago, although his family originated from Malta. His father still lived in America at that time. He had a strong American accent. 1932, his business went bad and he moved to the UK. So he was a good couple of years younger than Fifi, but they seemed to get on really well and he really liked her. They both really liked each other. He didn't seem to have a problem with the fact that she was a prostitute. We're unsure whether he was a client. He may have been. This sometimes happens, that men kind of meet up with their prostitutes and then they slightly fall in love with them. got on well with each other. He didn't have a place to stay, so he kind of lived out of hotels. Working as an extra, he was earning about £7 a week, so he was doing okay. But the more he started to get into drug abuse, the more things started to get worse. In here, it was weird because they kept referring to him as being put in a nursing home. And a nursing home is the old, what they would call kind of the place where drug addicts would go, do you know, rehab centres. Obviously, they call it nursing homes back in the 30s. But in his hotel room, there was loads of needles everywhere. And so he was a massive heroin addict. I'm not going to do any more. I think that's more it, because I don't want to ruin next week's Oojimmy Doodly Doodly thingamajobs. Also, it means I can go to the coffee shop and charge up my laptop. Oh, throat is sore. So let's do the quiz questions, and then I will say goodnight to you. It's not really goodnight, it's 3:38 at the moment. There we go. I've just finished before the kids start coming out and ruining my recording, little bastards. So let's do answers to the questions. Name the three clubs which were nearest and... Oh, for fuck's sake. Name the three clubs which were nearest or in 3 Archer Street. I can't remember how I rephrased that better earlier on, but you know what I'm saying. The clubs were the Windmill Club, which is still there today. It's on the corner of Archer Street and Great Windmill Street. The Cairo Club, which was in the basement, and the Globe Club, which was on the first floor. We will see more of this later on about... These aren't big buildings. They're just regular kind of... this was a 5-storey building. It's probably about 30 or 40 feet wide. Probably 30 feet wide. So it's not big, but these aren't massive nightclubs. These are kind of like someone's front room, really. Illegal kind of drinking dens, you know, bit of gambling, blah, blah, blah. Question number 2. What was Fifi's last known meal? It was fried eggs and tea. Question number 3. What was Fifi's birth name? It was Josephine Mécanique. Question number 4. What was her parents' nationality and religion? They were Russian Jews. Question number 5. In which part of Paris was Fifi a prostitute? It was Rue Pigalle. Question number 6. Where did her husband Henry work? He was a waiter at the Trocadero. Question number 7. So it's likelihood is they may have met there, because Trocadero was part of the... Is this one of the questions coming up? No, it's not. Trocadero was part of the Lion's Cornerhouse Tea Room, which was on the corner of Coventry Street. So the buildings are connected. So it's true that they may have met there, or it could have been staged, fixed up as a white slave trade thing. We don't know. That's why in this episode there's a lot of possibly, because prostitution is kind of difficult to kind of pin stuff down. I'm waffling. Question 7. César was deported back to which country? Home of the waffle? It was Belgium. Question number 8. What part of Soho was Fifi's patch? It was Glasshouse Street. Question number 9. What hospital did she go to for cancer treatment? It was Middlesex Hospital. And question number 10. Where did she meet Jimmy Orr? Well, there you go. I've just done the answer to the question there. but I didn't ruin it. Lion's Cornerhouse Tea Room in Piccadilly. That's the one on Coventry Street. So... still recording? Still recording. That's good. That's always nice to see. So I think that's me done. Come on, where's my mouse? There we go. Mouse just seems to disappear when it bloody wants to, little bastard. So that's me done. Hope you enjoyed that. 9 more episodes to go, which means we'll be done middle of April. So middle of April, and then there's lots more. I spent ages in the archives pulling out, like, you're going to have loads of cases this year that no one's ever heard of. This no one's heard fully. There's crappy bits in some shitty true crime books out there. I'm not going to name them. I've got one of them here. Fuck's sake. The writer hasn't even bothered to do the research. He's opened up a handful of newspapers and copied down what's in there. So this is the truth. This is the fact here. This is based on evidence, not this shite. But there's loads of cases that I've never heard of, and I'm really excited to dive into them. So lots. We're going to run up. We will do a little bit of the Daily Inch over summer to give me a bit of a break to do some more research. And then we'll got more episodes leading to Christmas. This is my first episode. Oh, my God. It's going to kill me. Right. That's me done. Have yourself a good one, folks. Stay safe and be good. And thank you to everyone for supporting the show and continue to listen to the show. Best wishes. Lots of love.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.